February. How can we never give that R what it deserves?
February. Yeah. We just go right into the U. That's true. February.
February. We got to put the brew back in February.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for February 2025. I'm your host, Jonathan Butcher, and I am joined once again by an actual Chiefs fan, Mr. Tim Nelson. Tim, there aren't too many Chiefs and Eagles fans for this game coming up on Sunday, but you live in the actual city of Kansas City. How's the vibe there these days?
People are excited. They're donning their gear. Their ketchup and mustard looking gear. Yeah, yeah, it's good. Everybody rocking around looking like a hot dog.
It's a big deal. I remember when Green Bay went to the Super Bowl in 2011 or whatever, and we like it was decked out. People would you'd go to the grocery store. Everyone's in Packer gear. That's what's fun about sports. It's a very community thing. So yeah,
that's pretty exciting. Yeah, so we've been doing this a lot lately, going to the Super Bowl.
A lot. Yeah, you're on a three-peat, which would be unprecedented.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what they tell me. And it's just, I don't know, man. I don't love dynasties. I'm going to be totally honest with you. I prefer underdog stories over like people who win and win and win. So I'm not rooting for the Chiefs, but I still love you. And I hope you have a good time watching the game.
Let me tell you something that happened, John.
Okay.
Have I told you about Taylor Swift?
Oh, gosh. So that's the other thing I'm not looking forward to about the game. The 50th Taylor Swift shot. No, please. Tell me more about Taylor Swift.
You don't sound like you're very open, John.
I'm sorry. I don't like her very much. I've tried getting into her music. I can't do it. But I want to hear the story. Did you meet Taylor Swift? Did you meet her?
I think you're the problem, John. It's you.
I probably am the problem. I know. Millions of fans disagree with me.
So the story is this. As much as you hate the Chiefs because you're jelly.
Correct.
One of the girlfriends, as everyone knows, of Travis Kelce, the girlfriend is the one and the only Taylor Swift. Now, I work in a children's hospital, John, and this is what happened about a month ago, maybe a little longer, is that Taylor came to visit at the hospital.
You were there?
No, I was there. Now, however, She came to the unit that I work on. She visited with some very nice people, some kids that are heart kids, and I missed it because there was a chaplain lunch going on at the time. Oh. And the whole unit has a picture, and I am not in it.
Tim!
And I didn't get to meet Swift. Yes.
I mean, that is a big deal. Even as one who doesn't prefer her, I would still recognize that as a huge missed opportunity. I'm so sorry. That's a big one.
So yeah. I'm feeling pretty bad about that. However, Chiefs players regularly show up, and they hang out with the kids.
Do you know what else we missed? When I was in Kansas City, we went to that like celebrity event for
big
a charity.
Slick.
We also missed out. They went to the office, apparently. There's some celebrities, and we could have gone too. So we're just always missing out.
Yeah, so there's even, maybe I can get you into the hospital when you come here next. I don't know. I don't want to put you in the hospital, but get you in is okay.
Right.
So what I'm thinking is this. You can come see where Paul Rudd, Jason Sudeikis, Eric Stone Street.
Oh, yeah.
Who am I thinking? Rob Riggle. And then who's Champ Kind? I forgot the guy's name.
Yeah. Right. From Anchorman.
From Anchorman.
Yeah. I forget his name, too. But we know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we know who you're talking about. So there's a thing where they all signed it, and they are an artist at they're cartoons. And they're like cartoon animals, and they're bowling. And you can see where that was. My other friend met all of them. But I've only met Eric Stone Street.
Well, we got to correct that this year. Maybe.
Let's work on it. Let's see what we can do, John.
Yes.
And we'll hang out and have some espresso with them, I think.
Espresso. Yeah, that's what they do, those LA folks.
Yeah, they can work. They can try their new sets on us. It'll be great.
All right. Well, here we are. This is our last podcast covering the 2024 movie season. We will then end with the Oscars, which are on March 2nd. And then we're going to take a break in March, and we'll be back in April. So that is the schedule. And this is our last film of 2024 we're going to be talking about. So exciting.
It is exciting.
All right, Tim. So you've had a long time to prepare for this, and you knew this question was coming. Tim, what have you been watching? You haven't thought about it for 1 second before now, have you?
I thought about it for 2 seconds while you were asking the question, but I will give you my answer.
Okay, go.
I have been watching The Brutalist. No, I've been watching The Last of Us, but I'm only a couple episodes in.
Yes. Have you gotten to that one glorious episode?
Don't say anything.
What episode are you on?
Two.
Okay.
But I'm committed, and my son's like, slow down, I got to watch it with you. And I haven't had him want to do that for a while, but I'm just going to pretend that I saw it for the first time.
Well, one of the best episodes of television is coming up very soon for you, so congratulations.
Of all time?
Well, of the season, and I would say of that year. I would have to think about all time, but yeah.
Better than the Full House Hawaii episode.
Shut up. No. Mm. Oh, I love the Hawaii episode. And where they rocked out with the, what's the band that Jesse's actually in? He's actually in it. The Beach Boys.
He's in the Beach Boys. Oh, the Beach Boys are in that episode.
Yeah. And he is also a part of the band. He tours with them in real life. True story.
What?
Yes.
Is that true?
He plays drums, I believe. I want to say that. Yeah.
Uncle Jesse.
Jesse.
Is it the Wailers? No, that's Bob Marley.
The
Rippers? Is it the Rippers?
That sounds right.
Uncle
the Rippers.
Jesse and the Rippers.
Gosh, Tim, I just want to be back, you know, kind of hanging upside down from my grandparents' couch, like 12 years old watching Full House. Like nothing. That was the best time of my life, and I didn't appreciate it. That was it.
Let's talk a little more Full House right now. Do you know that the character that was supposed to be the funny main character was supposed to be Stephanie?
No, I didn't know
that.
Yes,
and then the twins, Mary-Kate and Ashley Super Richen, took over the funny.
Oh, right, because they were so adorable. It just worked on, and they went with it. Yeah.
So then Stephanie became like a true middle child. Yeah.
Yeah, but the finale was Stephanie falling off her horse, so it all came around.
Oh, was it?
Oh, yeah. It was a two-parter, and man, did she have a concussion? I don't know. It was scary. All right.
There was no protocol back then.
Exactly. Okay. So, good. Well, you've been watching The Last of Us. It's a great show. I want to share what I've been I want to share, Tim, a movie, a TV show, and are you ready for this? This is unprecedented.
Yes, yes.
A song.
Really?
I know.
We do music
it doesn't
now?
Even make sense. It doesn't even make sense. But we're going to do it because this is my podcast and I'm going to do what I want.
I have one caveat because I'm here as a guest. Uh-huh. My one caveat is you have to sing it.
Oh, no. Okay, I will. I will maybe sing a portion.
All right.
Okay.
John actually has a nice singing voice. Everyone.
No, I don't. All right, I'm going to fly through this. So, first
fly
of all.
Fly me to the moon. Come on, John.
Do you remember Kyle Burnt? We've talked about him. We talked about his spreadsheet. We talked about how he always makes me watch movies before game day. Well, the Burnts came over for dinner, and Kyle wanted to show us his favorite movie. I had seen this maybe 20 years ago, but none of my other family had seen it. It's called, you probably heard of it, Contact. With Jodie Foster. Yes.
Yeah.
This is Kyle's favorite movie. Now, I didn't remember hardly anything about it. So we all sat down, Kyle and my whole family, and this is a 2.5 hour. I'm playing this thing, and it's like going to be 2.5 hours. I'm like, oh my gosh. And it starts off very small and very like kind of indie. And I'm just like, this is, I don't know. But then it became such a great movie, Tim. Contact is a great movie. People need to watch this movie again. It holds up. It's fantastic. Jodie Foster kills it, and it asks really great questions about God and life, and it's wonderful.
In the sci-fi genre.
Yeah, in the sci-fi genre. So thank you, Kyle, for Contact. And then, okay, on Max, there is a show called Phantasmas. So this showrunner dude named Julio Torres, well, actually, he was a Saturday Night Live writer, and then he made this show called Los Espookies, which is because he's of Mexican descent, and it's in Spanish. That was really good. But this is his next show. It's called Phantasmas, and what's interesting about it is that it's very, like, surrealist. So it's like this loose plot about this kid who is trying to get, he thinks this mole is concerning on his neck, but in order to get a biopsy, he needs a proof of existence, they call it. And he's got this robot. And so he's trying to so it's a very loose plot. But then what'll happen is in the middle of an episode, he'll like look at his phone and it'll be like an ad for a TV show. And then we'll go inside that TV show. And so then it'll be 15 minutes of this TV show. And so before you know it, you're wrapped up in this whole other story and you're just like really invested in this mini like story, and then all of a sudden you're back to this other main thing, and that's what the whole show is. It's going weaving in and out of these interesting, crazy rabbit holes, and it's really fun and funny and like fascinating and weird, and I was digging it. So it's called Phantasmas.
They're ghosts.
There's no ghosts. No.
But that's the name of the show, isn't it?
No. Los Spookies was his previous show, but Phantasmas, it's not. But it's good. It's really good, and you should check it out.
Where is it at? I didn't remember what you said.
It's on Max, so you got this. You could watch it if you wanted to. But yeah, it's on Max.
You know I have Max because you forced me to buy it, and I was kind of kicking and screaming. And then
I was at your house when I forced you to sign up for that.
You're like, you have to get this, and I was like, oh gosh, another service. And then
it is essential.
It's pretty great, and I am of a generation that doesn't mind commercials.
Oh, so you got the commercial version.
So I got the commercial version.
Saving money.
It's like, yeah, but it always like markets me. I'm very simple, so it always markets me like one thing. So the new Jeep Cherokee. And I'm like, I don't want a Cherokee, but I'm going to hear about it 500 times.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I hear you. So anyway, there's that. And then finally, the long promised song. All right, Tim. So I'm 39 years old and I'm a father of three and I have officially discovered dad rock. Are you familiar with the work of Bob Seger?
Yeah.
I like
him. Rock.
Like a rock.
Is that the song?
No, but that's not the song.
Stand an arrow straight.
The song is Night Moves. Has anyone else heard this amazing song?
Everyone's heard this song of a certain age.
I've never heard it, and I stumbled upon it 3 days ago, and I can't stop listening to it. I think it's a work of genius. Night Moves. Working on the Night Moves.
Dun, dun, dun.
So good. So good, Tim. Bob Seger.
John, do you know that song's about sex, John?
Is it really? Oh,
Night Moves.
Okay. Well, I heard it in the... So I find most of my great music in the credits of shows, like, because, you know, these people who make these shows, they always put really great songs at the closing credits, and it's very vague, visually oriented and everything. So that's where I heard it, and it was not about sex during that, where it was first played, so I didn't put that together. And plus, I'm a guy who doesn't like looking up lyrics. I think it's better to not know what a song is about. And I also think that you should have your own lyrics in your head, regardless of whether they're the real lyrics. And it's all up to you, the listener. That's what I think. But, you know, we always have disagreed about that with art. I'm always like trying to take things in a what I believe direction. You're like, I don't think that was their intention.
It's about sex.
It's about sex.
So I finally found it, according to the good old Wikipedia. Which, if for the folks that don't know what Wikipedia is, you should Wikipedia it.
Definitely.
Find out. So, according to this, it's a coming-of-age tale about adolescent love and the adult memory of it. A teenage love affair in which he experienced in the 1960s. It took him 6 months to write Night Moves. That's a long time.
That's a long time.
It's very, I guess, very important to him. So it's about teenage sex now.
Teenage
so it got
sex.
Worse. It
well,
got worse.
Look, you know what? We're all consenting adults. We all love sex. And so there's nothing wrong with listening to a song about it. So there you go. Listen to Night Moves. It's a great song. If you haven't heard it, you will be dancing around your house like me for the last 3 days to this amazing song. That's all I have to say about it.
I see. Hey, check this out.
Yeah.
The catalyst for writing Night Moves came after Seger saw the 1973 film American Graffiti.
Oh, great movie. George Lucas, if you need a reminder that George Lucas once had talent, you should watch American Graffiti. It's a great film.
So this is a great example of how a film inspired a musician and then you were inspired by Scream.
Like 60 years later. See how amazing that is?
It's 50 years later.
Okay,
it's like,
50.
It's 48 years later. Uh-huh. Oh, 47. Uh-huh. No, 49 years later. You're right. It's a long time.
Yeah.
So put on that thing and work on your Night Moves.
I'm working on it. I don't have to work on it, Tim. I know it. Just kidding.
Oh, John's an expert in the Night Moves.
Expert at the Night Moves. No. Okay. Moving on, Tim, we both had to venture. Let's just talk about movies, I guess. I guess this is a movie podcast, I've heard. So let's do that.
Moving pictures?
We had to venture out to a theater for this one. No streaming, unfortunately. And so, therefore, we can talk about our theater experience. Tim, did you go to that one awesome avant-garde theater you were talking about? Where did you catch this?
No, I had to catch it when I could. And so basically I was like, do I have a Saturday weekend? Do I need a hotel for where I'm
exactly.
going?
Exactly. You need it, right?
Yeah. Did I bring Gatorade and towels and everything? I need to be ready for this thing.
So long.
So it was kind of like the Super Bowl. I had to get ready and I timed everything exactly right because I know the preview length. So the preview length on this movie was 25 minutes.
That is absurd. I mean, it's really bad. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. 25 minutes. And the film is like never ending. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I went to my good old theater, my AMC. It was not the most popular. There were kids standing in line to watch Dog Man.
Oh, boy.
In the big theater. So yeah. I went to one of their sub theaters or whatever. And there were a few people in there. It's one of those theaters that's got that smell like people have been sitting on the seats for years. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It's gross. I know everyone knows that smell, but we don't talk about it enough. You know what I'm saying?
It's like that's human great. Detritus. Yeah. You're like, oh, there's a lot of cells in here on this seat.
100,000 butts. That's what that it's smells like.
It's like butt sweat. Yeah. So it's got that butt sweat smell that only like an old van or a theater can have.
Yeah, mixed with popcorn. It's a very unique smell. You really know it when you...
It's the smell of if you never washed your towels. Okay? Yeah. It's like, at first it's kind of clean smelling because of soap, and then it turns, it's just stale like old sweet bread. So gross. So I sat in that.
Mm-hmm. For 3.5 hours.
Yeah. Well, I got hungry, John, and you know how I am. I don't like buying food at the theater.
Oh, I know.
And I can't eat popcorn. So I took a dive. You probably had this before. I jumped in.
Uh-huh.
I jumped into pretzel bites.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Pretzel bites work. I love them. You got the cheese sauce where you dip in?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is at AMC, John, mm-hmm. a $17 pretzel.
Oh, God. That's so expensive.
I was like, does it come with filet?
Yeah, right.
There's a $17 pretzel. It has some name. I can't remember what the name is, but it's gigantic.
I like that better than the actual bites.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was one whole thing and then you tore it apart, or was it actual mini pieces?
I got the bites because I looked at the... They put the calories on the pretzel.
Yeah.
And the pretzel had like 2,000 calories.
Well, of course it does. We're not counting calories. No, but I think I would prefer the big pretzel because then you control the bite ratio and I just feel like it would taste better. There's something about those bites. They can get a little hard, you know, and I feel like it'll be softer with the pretzel, but, you know, anyway.
Hey, man, I trust you. You know about the night moves, so I trust you in the theater situation with pretzels. I think you know what you're doing. So I got the bites, you know, not wanting to have to take bites and all, being a lazy guy. And I got the pretzel bites, and they had some kind of weird, gross sauce that smelled... I'm trying to think what it kind of matched the theater smell. It's like garlic parmesan.
It's like off butt. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just slightly off butt. Yeah. And so I got those down and I got some Raisinets to like a chaser. Raisinets are good.
Yeah, Raisinets are good. They say Raisinets and popcorn is really good, but you can't have the popcorn.
No. Don't even talk about it anymore.
Okay.
Popcorn. Everyone should eat an extra thing of popcorn from me.
Just on Tim, yeah.
You should pour it out to me like you would with your dead homies. Just to your live guys that can't eat popcorn. Just pour a little out in the theater.
Sounds good. Think of me. Did you love the intermission? Wasn't the intermission great? I'm like, thank you. Why doesn't every freaking movie have this intermission?
Did you sit through the intermission?
No, no, no. I went right out right away because I always need to go to the bathroom and like, you know, in the middle of a movie. And so I'm like, great. Now's my opportunity. I got a refill. I'm talking with someone at the soda machine about the film we're talking about. Like, that's what the intermission brings to our life and we need it.
Do you think we should have movies that are formatted for old people like me and you?
Well, I think like every movie had an intermission back in the day, right? What's wrong with it? It's just a break. It's just a chance to like think about something for a second and then get right back into it. I don't know. I don't think it's mainly old people.
Well, I'm kind of thinking we need a pee break, us old guys.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's
like,
true.
We could have the, you know how they have different versions, IMAX. They could have Prostate Max.
Tim, I am starting to do the middle of the night pee, and I'm like, oh no, this is what they talk about.
You're a man of a certain age. That's what's happening.
I'm getting there. Oh no.
Yeah. You just go in there and just try to go back to sleep. Here's the key for all you old guys like John and I. John got old this year, apparently.
Fairly.
Pretty close.
Pretty close.
He's got a little gray in his beard.
Yeah, I do. I do.
He's got life under his... He's got a few miles on his motor. I don't know. I'm trying to come up with a nice metaphor. It's not really working.
Yeah, bring it back to night moves every time. Okay.
He's got night... He's been around the earth long enough to have night moves. Okay? And to look back on them even.
Yeah.
So, John, we need a format for old people. And what it would have is more lighting so we can see things. No cell phones. And yes. It will have three breaks in it where you can go pee.
Three?
Yeah, or fart.
Okay.
Yeah. And it would be called old, maybe Old Max. What do you think? We could come up with an idea.
Old Max. Yeah, that's nice.
Old Max format.
I'm just concerned for our listeners. I don't think we've ever mentioned bodily functions so much in one podcast. It's pretty great.
And then we could turn it up or turn it down. They could even be like headphones, like hearing aids.
Right.
You ever seen this? Yeah.
Yep. In the theater, they do that for the hearing impaired. They'll have headphones, you know, where they can turn it up or whatever they need to do.
So I like these ideas that I have.
You always have great ideas.
I would like to second my ideas and maybe put it to a vote. Yes, I agree with you, Tim. Yep. All right.
All in favor? Good.
Old
good.
Max.
Old Max.
The old Max format. Yep.
So speaking of this, I had a theater experience, Tim. All right. So about 5 minutes before the intermission, well, maybe like 10, and I didn't know because like I hadn't seen the movie before, so I didn't know we were almost at the intermission. These kids just randomly, this is an hour and a half into the movie, just start having a very loud conversation as if they just woke up and they decided, oh, I want to talk about things. And so very loudly talking. Everyone in the theater starts looking back. And it's like, what?
Okay, that's the first move. We talked about this.
Yeah, yeah.
The first move is to look back.
Yes. And so everyone did that. We did the whole theater. And I look back. I'm trying to make out what's going on. They're in the back corner. They're on their phones. And they're just having a conversation as if no one's here, as if they're not in a movie. Mm. So I give it about 5 to 10 minutes. Maybe 8 minutes. Like, I wanted to give a little bit of a leash for the parents, you know, hopefully, to come in or something. They're teenagers. They're probably like 15. And I'm like, where are the parents? I don't know. And so I give it some time. And then finally, I decide, which is very out of character for me, by the way, I decide to make the move. So I stand up and I give everyone a little like, you know, I got this. I got this, guys.
Oh, wow, John.
I know.
So
I know.
Confrontational.
We're like, you know, not all heroes wear capes. So
you were working on your night moves. Wow.
It was. It was like 10
what
at night.
A move.
So I go up to the back corner, and all I did, I'm not trying to be confrontational, I'm not threatening them. I just did a little finger to the mouth. A little shh. That's all I did. Go back to my seat.
You were like, shut the front door. Did they throw popcorn at you?
No. I go back to my seat. They proceed to talk louder, and then they start screaming. One of them starts screaming at the top of his lungs, and he goes, I don't even want to be here! And then they marched out of the theater. That's what happened.
Wow!
And then it was the intermission. And then literally like 2 minutes later, boom, intermission. And I'm like, what just happened? Like, I missed the whole scene before the intermission, and then, yeah, there you go.
So this, everyone, is the equivalent of yelling at kids for walking on your grass.
Is it bad? I felt bad about it.
So John likes to have guilt about stuff that I think is funny.
Uh-huh.
And
it's true.
This is just funny. Who dragged him to this movie?
Exactly. And where are the parents? Why aren't they they're the first line of defense. They should have run up there and be like, guys, no. We're in a movie. Where were they?
I'm having a hard time thinking that teenagers wouldn't love The Brutalist.
I don't know.
I don't see why they weren't in the front row.
I think you're being sarcastic.
Glued to their seat.
I mean,
because this not only does this talk about the post-Holocaust
mm-hmm.
Jewish experience in America.
It's 3.5 hours long, every teenager's dream.
But it talks about obscure architectural movements.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
I mean, what is there not to like for a teenager?
It's a dream for them. Yeah.
So there's the fast and the fierce. They might have like, this is the slow and the tedious. And they are struggling. You know what I mean?
Nice.
They're struggling here.
Well, I was proud of myself for being assertive. It doesn't come in my nature, but you know, it ended weirdly. I still don't know what to make of it. Still, they didn't come back.
Did they egg your car or jump you?
No, they weren't waiting for me out in the theater, which I half expected, but they did not come back. So did the parents leave with them? Maybe I feel bad. I don't know. It's just, what are you
from the
do?
Limited information that you're providing to us right now, John,
mm-hmm.
I think they didn't even want to be there.
It definitely felt like that. Yeah. And they, in fact, they stated it very loudly.
Yes, I think they didn't want to be there, John.
Yeah. Well, I just feel bad if I robbed their parents of the viewing experience. But you know what? You got to make better choices, maybe. I don't know.
Don't you think it's the other way around, John? Maybe their parents robbed you.
Yeah, true. I missed 5 minutes. I really still don't know what happened in that last scene before the intermission. Anyway. All right, Tim. Let's move along. It's your turn to describe the plot. I'm handing it over to you. What do you got? What's this movie about? We're watching The Brutalist. What's it about?
Well, I don't know what it's about, but here's what kind of happens. In post Nazi Germany, it's post-war world, right? And you have folks that are trying to be refugees because they're trying to get out of these awful places. So you have concentration camp survivors. And in this case, we have a man who is a famous architect in Budapest, which is Hungary. And after the Holocaust after World War II, he immigrates to the United States.
Name's Laszlo. Yep. Mm-hmm.
His name is Laszlo. And so Laszlo comes to the United States. And so kind of the first half of this is him struggling to make it. It's like a kind of a struggle story, an immigrant story. And he's struggling to make it. He isn't recognized initially for his architectural skill. He has a lot of conflict with the people he's staying with because they don't, I think they're a little bit afraid to offend Gentiles because they're Jewish and they're trying to just get a foothold in America and survive. In the process of this, he is discovered by a wealthy, what do you call it when you sponsor someone? There's a name for this.
Well,
a wealthy patron.
Sure. Patron.
Wealthy patron.
Van Buren.
Yeah. Van Buren. And he's a wealthy, waspy patron who made a bunch of money. I think it's steel. Is that right?
Something like that. Yeah.
Anyway, the background's Pittsburgh, so that would make sense. And so he goes through this process. He has a wife and a niece who are still in the old country, and he's trying to get them back over here, and it kind of goes through all the hoops he has to jump in order to A, get them here, but also to become the to get to the level of artistry that he previously had achieved in Budapest pre-war. So he's commissioned to build this gigantic thing that's like almost like a community center in his style, would be the brutalist architect style, which is, you know, obviously it doesn't mean just that style for the movie title, but he does it in this style that is kind of shocking to his community, shocking to some of the world, because it is so very different than the styles that preceded it. It's revolutionary, it angers a lot of people, but it's also pretty significant in architectural movements. So we get to follow this process. It's a long process that takes years and years and years to build this huge edifice. And so we follow that process and we see what happens, the conflict, the difficulty, and eventually we see an outcome here. So I'm not going to say what that is yet.
Beautiful. That's great. Thank you, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's talk about these characters, which will help fill in some more of the details if you're listening and haven't watched it. So we'll begin with Adrian Brody. Tim, I'm going to say it. I think we've been taking Adrian Brody for granted. This is a tremendous actor. He's on his second Oscar nomination. When the guy's on, he's as good as anybody. What do you think about Adrian Brody?
I like Adrian Brody. I don't know why I don't know why he's not in more stuff.
Well, here's what happened. I mean, he came out, like, he kind of came around around the edges. He was a supporting character in Thin Red Line, Summer of Sam, or whatever. And then The Pianist, he blows up, right?
He's huge. He gets best actor, right?
Kisses Halle Berry, which she did not see coming, and that, you know, probably, this is pre-Me Too, so that's very frowned upon. But it was still controversial back then, but nowadays it'd probably be called assault. But anyway, does that at the Oscar ceremony. Anyway, wins Best Actor, and then all the doors in Hollywood are open to him, so he makes a ton of movies, and I think he just got overexposed, is my theory. He was in The Jacket, that horror movie, which I did see.
Never saw that.
The Village, M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. He was in King Kong, Peter Jackson's big King Kong movie. So he was in all this stuff over the course of a year or two, and I just think he was in too much, and like there was a little bit of a backlash, and then he just sort of disappeared. Now he's been working this whole time, but it's very like voice work, TV work, a movie here and there.
Wes Anderson work, you know, like subpar films.
He's in all of Wes Anderson's movies.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, I said that just to bother Dan.
Dan Baker loves Wes Anderson. I don't know why.
No, actually, I don't mind Wes Anderson. I like him. He's creative.
Yeah, he made one great movie called Rushmore and then repeated that movie 8 more times.
I stand with Dan on this. I think it's pretty great. Not just Rushmore. I think he has a good catalog, and it's quirky and fun and artistic.
All right.
So I'll stand with Dan on this. I was just joking, but apparently you hate Wes.
Anyway, I don't get when we start. He's too precious. That's what I'll say about him. Just too precious.
But you're a middle-aged white guy. You're supposed to like Wes Anderson.
I know. I'm Tweety. Okay. Anyway, so he's back, and he's so good. And I loved this performance, and I love this character, and the guy's awesome. So what do you think of him as Laszlo? What do you think of Laszlo as a character? Interesting character.
He's interesting. He's like clearly has to play a character that's damaged. So he's always thinking, he is seeking to like have a new life. He doesn't look back too often, actually.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. and doesn't really want to stand on his past. He wants to just be in the present.
But he has a lot of damage from the past, clearly. He's a drug addict, a sex addict, maybe. I don't know. He's just got a lot of stuff going on that he's trying to cope with the pain. And there's clearly just a lot of trauma because they were in concentration camps. Him, his wife, their life was destroyed.
Yeah. So he has a lot of stuff going on there. He doesn't really do a good job at... He really just wants to do his work. Like, he's very dedicated. He's like, I'm just going to do my work. And he doesn't have some kind of like grand immigrant plan either.
Right.
Like, he's shoveling coal. He'll do whatever. And he gets through the day. And that's kind of what he does. He loves his wife, but he has a hard time with a lot of human connections sometimes. He definitely is very damaged.
Yeah.
He's very traumatized. So he plays a highly traumatized character who's also incredibly intellectual.
Yeah.
So
really smart.
Talented. Yeah. So it's a very, the performance is very nuanced, and I thought Brody nailed it.
Totally. Up for best actor, much deserved. Wouldn't mind him winning, honestly. It's just there's so many layers there, and it's really good. He's not a saint, and he's a mix of everything.
But he's also like a very religious guy. He goes to synagogue constantly.
And a good person beneath all of the brokenness, too. Like, we see little glimpses of that, right? Where he'll like hold the line, or he'll fight for a kid to have bread, and he'll just like go out of his way to help people.
Yeah, and he's constantly, he has to balance survival with art. And he's pretty much unwilling to yield on his art. He'd rather starve.
Mm-hmm. An inch. He wants it to be his vision. And someone tries to interfere and he will end you. Yeah.
Right. So he's so quiet and mellow, and he'll listen and listen and listen. And as soon as you step onto his turf, which is architecture, he'll jump on you.
I love that scene where he's decimating that guy verbally. And he's like, everything about these plans that are dumb and awful are you, or something
and
like
ugly
that.
He,
ugly
are because of you.
So funny.
And it was like all true. Yeah.
And you think that he's gonna make peace with them because they were fighting, and then he calls him over like he's gonna say sorry, and then he lays into the, it's so great, such a great
that
scene.
Was like one of the best scenes in the film, because you saw he was like unyielding.
Yep.
And he was willing to die on that hill, literally, right?
Yeah. He'll even give up his own fee for the project just to keep it to his vision, and like pay for the own materials to keep it to what he wants. So yeah, definitely dedicated, obsessed, you could say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about Felicity Jones, plays Laszlo's wife Erzsébet. Is that how they were pronouncing it in the movie, Erzsébet?
I don't remember.
That's how it's spelled. Anyway, let's call her Erzsébet. We're so good at pronunciations. I just love this. Everyone loves it.
I don't attempt them, so I let you do it. I don't lose any points.
We heard the name 100 times in the movie and I can't remember. It's so sad. Okay. Anyway, Felicity Jones. So I remember her from The Theory of Everything. There was that movie about Stephen Hawking, Eddie Redmayne, and she was nominated for an Oscar for playing his wife, Stephen Hawking's wife. Did you ever see that?
Yes, I did see it, but it's been a long time.
It's been a long time. So that's where I remember. She was also in Rogue One, which is a pretty good Star Wars spinoff movie. So she's been in some things. This is definitely, though, the best I've ever seen her. And what I liked about her character was that it plays so well off of Laszlo because it's so different. Like, she finally comes to America, and I'm trying to figure out how to describe her. She's like strong and fierce, but also kind and genuinely like just radiates this beauty and warmth, but like also stands up for justice and isn't afraid to call out something for what it is. And her dynamic with Laszlo is so great. What'd you think of her?
I liked her. Here's what I found really strange about this. I don't know how they accomplished it. I don't know how she accomplished that. Is you take an incredibly attractive woman and you make her seem really unattractive in this. Like, she's like not sexually attractive. Like, they managed. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they did it. Like, yeah. I was like, why am I not attracted to her? I don't get it. Like, why is she not aesthetic? There's something about her that is like, yeah, she's physically damaged from famine in Russia, so she can't walk. But she's also like her. Yeah. So they both have like this survival default a little bit, and hers is very strong. Mm-hmm. So she's like, we will survive. You will go back and like swallow your pride, and we are going to survive. And so it's kind of they represent like these two approaches to surviving. So she's like kissing butt and like always talking about literature and this and that. And she's a PhD.
Yeah, right.
So she's like underrepresents herself constantly.
Right, because she ends up working at this, like, to be a columnist for a woman's magazine or something. And she was like a PhD.
A real
writer.
Journalist.
Yeah, journalist. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, she's a very interesting character. Both of them. She's also up for Best Actress. Just both killing it with these performances and these wonderful, layered, rich characters. I could watch them all day. Like, it's just mm-hmm. their dynamic is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, so I thought they were great. The interactions they have seem... like he has a hard time having intimacy with her.
Yeah. What did you think when she first comes back on that first night and they're in bed and he seems so like upset with her? Is it because he's ashamed of his own infidelity? Was it like, it was just so weird because it's their first night back and he's just feels like he's ticked off at her. She says, is it because I didn't tell you about my disability because she's in a wheelchair? I don't know. It was just like, it was very ambiguous. And I've been thinking about
it. I don't think infidelity. I think like the first scene shows that he has fidelity to her. Is that what you're talking about? The first scene.
Well, yeah, I mean, but he did cheat when they were married, and you know the movie depicts him cheating a lot. But I don't know. I was just talking about when they're in bed together, and he seems just kind of like angry at her, and I was wondering what that was about.
I don't know. So I think there's a complexity of emotion because he wants to get her back, but he doesn't like really work for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he accepts help to get her here. I think at first he deeply misses her, and then he gets her back, and she's not the same person that she was,
which is like maybe just traumatic to him. I don't know. Yeah, because he clearly loves her.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah,
but I think she's not the same person. She's very different. And do you remember like his objection to the prostitute in the first scene?
Yeah.
Oh, you have an ugly lip or something like that. So now she's like completely paralyzed. Not completely, but she can't walk anymore and she's in a wheelchair. So he's very aesthetically focused. Mm-hmm. So it's like he sees that. And I think that is hard for, that's going to be a difficult thing for him, right?
Oh, that's interesting. Aesthetically focused, right.
So because she's not, and then you think about the architecture is strong. It looks like a fortress or a bunker. Most of the architecture does.
It does, yeah.
And so like she is the opposite of that. So if that's his aesthetic, she looks like weak and kind of feeble and mm-hmm. can't do things.
Right. She's still very strong, but like there is a vulnerability there that I think does turn him off. Yeah.
And I think he has an artistic vision of who she is. And then when she gets off the train, she is not that vision at all. Mm. And because of the trauma, so I see like the physical trauma points us to the deeper trauma of being in concentration camps and surviving the Holocaust.
Right.
And starving.
Which is why she's in the wheelchair in the first place.
Right. Because she has osteoporosis because she was malnourished.
Yeah.
So I find that like that relation, the complexity of that relationship is rarely portrayed in film. I don't see things like that.
Right.
It's like he loves her, but he can't be with her well as far as intimacy. And he also respects her, but he is struggling with being traumatized and having her be traumatized. So he can't go back to what it was.
Yeah. That's good. You're right. It's very rare of a romance because it's not like we're so happy and this is our bad patch. It's just all of it at once, like, you know, and that felt very real to me. Yeah.
It's almost like their trauma is the common denominator there.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Guy Pearce. So Guy Pearce has been in a ton of movies. My favorite performance of his will always be Memento. Such a great Christopher Nolan movie. Of course, everyone's seen it. If you haven't, correct that as soon as possible. Memento is great, and he was the lead in that. But he's been in a ton of movies over the years. But what I've always liked about him is he sort of marches to his own beat. He's always been like famous as in known, but he's never been overexposed. Unlike Adrian Brody, he's never put himself out there too much. He just sort of has always flown a bit under the radar and doing his own thing. But I loved him in this role, but dang, was he creepy. So
creepy.
Nasty guy. Just this guy who has been rich his whole life. He loves the power dynamics that wealth gives him, and he loves lording it over people, and just kind of a slime bag. Yeah.
Yeah. But he comes off as being like this great champion of architecture at one point in the film.
Right.
And in a certain degree, yes, that's true, I guess. He's trying to build an edifice to him or his mom or whatever. so he comes off like a patron of the arts and like kind of intelligent, but he's always talking down to people.
Yep.
Even though he's, you know, he discovers folks. I think what's scary about him is he's clearly just as damaged as everybody else in the film.
Yeah.
He's damaged in different ways, and he's damaging currently in a lot of different ways too.
Damaging others, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So like his relationship with his son, like at first we think the son is the worst guy ever. And then we start realizing, oh no, the son has been damaged by the dad.
Yeah.
And he's just acting out that damage. The dad is like deeply disturbing and disturbed.
Good way to put it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I know. I really like that monologue that he gives when he's at his house talking to Adrian Brody. And he does this really long story about, I think it's getting his daughter back from the custody of her grandparents or something like that. And he talks about how I offered them like $30,000 and he didn't like the way they reacted to the money. Like they were like slightly disappointed at first, but then I saw them working out how this would fix all of their problems. And then he purposely doesn't sign the check and he leaves and they come running out after him. And then he says, I didn't like your reaction. Then he gives him $500. It's just such a brutal story. Like, and the way he takes, it's so long. It's like probably pages of dialogue and the way he delivers it. Really great scene.
Yeah. So he loves to control other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's like kind of his thing. And he likes to be in charge, but act like he's a patron of someone else. I mean, he is, I guess, technically, but yeah, he absolutely loves control, and he fancies himself an intellectual, and he uses this really flowery vocabulary where Brody is not necessarily doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trying to like show off his intellectualism in front of Brody. So he's like wants his approval, but he doesn't necessarily get that.
Yeah, he says like five times, he's like, I love our conversations, our intellectual conversations. It almost comes across as condescending. Well, and then he is responsible for Laszlo giving him an opportunity legitimately. Like he changes Laszlo's life, but it comes with these strings, man. Strings. Everything comes with strings with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's like the experience of a lot of people in America, right? Like in general, like now especially, which is you have to deal with people in power in order to do your art or your whatever you're called to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your vocation is, you have to deal with them. So how do you do that? And how do you keep your purity of your vision while also having to navigate these power structures that are malevolent?
I found that interesting because Laszlo clearly understands this guy's not good and the whole family is corrupt, but it's a delicate dance because he needs them to finish this thing that he is passionate about, that is his, but he has to dance around it. And you see him like slip sometimes and go a little too far in the hostility direction and have to pull it back. And I love the dance of that. Yeah.
Mm.
All right. Well, I briefly want to mention cinematography and music were both on point. They're both nominated. I don't know if you have anything to say about that. We got to keep it moving, but cinematography was so great in this movie, man. I mean, just the opening shot.
Totally agree.
Ugh. The inverse of the flag at the beginning and the cross at the end. It's so good. Yeah, both of those are great. Writing and directing. So Brady Corbett. So I first saw him when he was an actor. He was in the remake of Funny Games, which I remember there was a shot-for-shot remake of that horror film, and he was one of the bad guys in that. He's been in freaking 24. And then he transitioned to directing, as actors often do, and he's made three movies. First one was called The Childhood of a Leader, which I'd never even heard of, but apparently it's about this kid who grows up to become a fascist leader, and that sounds fantastic.
Weird.
Robert Pattinson. Yeah. And then he made this movie called Vox Lux with Natalie Portman and Jude Law, which is some sort of sci-fi musical thing. So I want to watch these movies. I wish I could have watched them, but I ran out of time. But interesting. And now here he is with The Brutalist and nominated for 10 Oscars.
I remember the previews for Vox Lux, but I never saw it. Maybe I should go see it.
I know. It's on my list. I'm going to check it out. So there's a lot to love with Brady Corbett. What do you think he brought to the writing and directing, Tim?
Actually, this is a fairly decently paced movie. We talk about pace a lot.
For 3.5 hours. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I thought that was good. He gives us enough dialogue to where he keeps us guessing like about like what's like, we're just never quite, we feel uncomfortable a lot in the film. So that's like a form of suspense to me.
Definitely.
And I feel like he does a really good job of that. Obviously symbolism, the idea for this movie is really a great idea. So like the overall idea of it is relevant. I mean, we're talking themes now, but I thought he did, the writing is great.
I like what you mentioned about tension, how he can bring tension in just scenes of dialogue. Like that takes skill both from a writing and directing standpoint, definitely.
Yeah, so I think that's what keeps it going, is that there's always like this uncomfortable, how will this resolve? And so it's not just a rags to riches story or something, mm-hmm. which is just like up and to the right kind of story. It's like a, oh, every step of this process of achieving his work is going to be like fraught with bizarre conversations. It's like the whole thing is like a awful negotiation.
Yes. Yeah. It's stressful. I know. And it zigs and it zags. And just when you think things are going well, then some new thing happens. And yeah, it's a twisty journey for sure.
I think like some of the other movies that we've looked at recently, there's a intellectual and a emotional components that make it very strong. So like there's a lot of things that you have to pick up on empathically. Like you have to put yourself in the position of the characters and think about feelings. And then you also have to think about what mousetrap is this guy walking into.
Right.
Which is more analytical. I thought it hit on all that.
I gotta say, Tim, I struggled with the ending. This is my one big criticism. So spoiler alert, we're gonna get into the minutiae of this, but basically Van Buren, we know he's really bad, but he crosses the line hardcore when they're on a trip to get some rocks for the structure, and he ends up raping Laszlo very nonchalantly, very animalistic, primal, just sort of does it while Laszlo's drunk and vulnerable, and then just moves on like nothing has happened. Now, the ending is sort of that Laszlo's wife confronts Van Buren in front of his whole family, confronts him about what he's done, and then gets dragged out of the place. And then Van Buren is, of course, like, I would never do that. But everyone in the room knows he would. Totally probably did it. And then Van Buren just disappears and they're searching for him. And so there's like 5-10 minutes of them searching for him, and that's it. And then it's an epilogue where they flash forward like 20 years later. I was so confused by that, because it's like, we really never find out what happened to Van Buren. We don't even know what happened to Laszlo and his wife. Like, did they go to Israel? He stayed and built some buildings. Did she die? Why would they just leave us hanging? After 3.5 hours, they had so much time to tell the story, and it felt like it was rushed at the end, which is just mind-boggling to me. What was your take on that?
So I feel like the epilogue is the key to everything. So first off, you can craft this story because it's fictional,
right?
Which is nice. At first, I thought this might be based on a true story. It has elements of true story in it.
It feels like it, but it isn't, right?
Yeah, yeah. But the idea of like that the altarpiece of the architecture is the Carrara marble, and it has to be just perfect. So like that's like the height of the building, right? Like that's the very center. Everything is drawing to the altarpiece. And the fact that he is raped in Carrara, in like basically like in a cave, right?
Yeah.
It's like he had to give like this. He had to like basically be brutalized in order to have his art realized. So I think that was highly symbolic.
That's good.
Yeah. And then the Carrara is brutal. And like, it looks like brutalist architecture. Carrara does all the slab mining and all that stuff. And they're cutting down this beautiful hill in order to make these beautiful buildings. So it's like, I don't know. I love the Carrara scenes. I just thought that was very interesting.
And I agree that the epilogue brings it back together, because we find out that the structure was actually, he was basing that off of the concentration camps that he and his wife suffered in. So he was actually building them kind of a replica of a conglomeration of the two, but also redeeming it with like this cross and everything. And so it was that was so cool, because it was like, now you understand why he was so obsessed with finishing this. It's almost like he was trying to redeem his past, trying to make something of this life that was destroyed against his will. So I like that, but didn't you feel it was a little incomplete? Like that jump was jarring.
I disagree. Like I think that it was, I don't know about the jump, but I think the idea of where we get the reveal basically is, okay, so you thought this was an edifice to this guy's mom. We thought this was an edifice to the church or to the community. And in reality, what it is at the top of the biggest hill in town, we have architecture that's exactly the same proportions as the camps. And the architecture looks like a German bunker. And everyone in the town is convinced that it's like just avant-garde and that this little bit of light that's coming in via the cross is like, that's, oh, this makes this beautiful and simple and all that stuff that brutalist architecture is. But in reality, what he does is he puts an edifice to his experience and his trauma on top of the hill, and his vision is realized and it's in concrete so that nobody can ever forget that this happened.
Yeah. And he even says that at one point about his architecture, that the reason he loves it is it will stand there. It will be there. It will stand the test of time. And so here is this monument to his suffering, his pain, and the redemption of it that's just going to be there forever. Yeah, exactly.
And he talks about how people will take the same architecture and they'll, like, the same architectural forms, because he was talking about his stuff in Budapest, and they will have a revolution based on the architecture, you know?
Yeah.
So the idea is, like, so he tricks everybody into thinking that this is this edifice that has at the center of it a Christian symbol, and it almost looks like a target, right? So this edifice looks like a Christian symbol, but in reality, it's a symbol of the Jewish experience and the trauma. And he could never possibly build that with the permission of people. So he has to be he basically is covertly doing this thing that is honoring his trauma and the trauma of his family and the suffering and misery. And so he does it with the dollar of this guy that's trying to exploit him. He flips it on him. And now he has basically used that guy to get his vision done. And so I thought, like, in the end, he wins in some ways, right?
Yeah. And it fills in so much of the gaps. We understand why he was so obsessed with finishing it. We understand why he didn't want anyone to alter any part of the plans, because it meant so much to him personally to get it exactly right. Yeah. Let's talk about some themes. So I want to say, first of all, this is an immigrant story, which feels very timely in 2025, Tim. I feel like there's some modern day relevance here. So, Laszlo comes to America because it's like a safe haven, right? He's a Jew. He's fleeing the Nazis. And yet there is still this idea, even in that first couple he stays with, there's still this idea, and he experiences it all the way through, that, like, yeah, you're welcome here, but, like, never forget who's on top of the food chain. Like, there's these constant reminders that, like, hey, don't forget you're an immigrant, you know? And I feel like you get that from the couple he stays with at first. You get that from Van Buren, obviously. And yeah, tough to be an immigrant in America all the way back then and today.
So it's an immigrant story. It's and then he has, like, one of the things is that he has, you know, his foreman or whatever, his number two guy is African-American dude that he met in a bread line when he was waiting for bread for his son. And so the idea is, like, oh, where do we see people waiting in bread lines and not getting enough to eat? Oh, maybe camps, right? Mm. So that America is not, we're drawn to this idea that America is, the immigrant story is, oh, come to America and there's all this opportunity. And if you work really hard, things will be great. But his experience is, oh, he's a famous architect, comes to America. There's racism. His own family is struggling. They change their names, so their identity is taken from them. They're Millers now instead of their Molnar. I can't remember what they were. So it's challenging your identity. And then people are poor and starving. And there is a class of people, just like there was in Europe, there's a class of people who are not, they're excluded from the economic food chain, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And social. So how different is it here is the question, you know? And we see that he experiences, like, he's in bread lines. What is that telling us? Oh, maybe this immigrant story is a little different than the typical one.
What's also fascinating to me is that, you know, he is an architect. He's like a revered architect back in his home. And then he comes here and people don't see him as that. They see an accent. They see a foreigner, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that happens today too. I have, my brother is married to a woman named Miriam. And when she was from Mexico. And when she's in Mexico, she was like in charge of a dental clinic. She was like the dentist of a clinic. She comes here. None of her licenses apply anymore. She has to start over, become a dental assistant. Basically, she's just treated like a nobody in the office, like absolute garbage. And back home, she was the doctor of the clinic. And that's, you know, and so what you have to give up and how people don't see you as who you are anymore when you come here. That's sad.
Yeah. And so I think we always talk about the myth of class dynamism, right? So, like, that you could ascend. But I think, like, we also see people in these immigrant stories descend from, like, oh, like, because I've met folks that are like, well, I'm a electrical engineer, but I have to drive a cab.
Right.
And you're like, oh, really? Okay. And so we don't get that narrative all the time. And so it's interesting that we get some of that narrative here.
And yet immigrants are so willing to work. Like, that's the thing, is that like they really did build this country, architecture, and so many other things. And they're willing to do a lot of the things that we don't want to do. So like these, immigrants nowadays are like, I was reading an article in the Times about how they're usually the ones in factories and doing very dangerous work. And they're so prone to mistreatment because you're supposed to shut down the machines to clean them. And then they'll like, but the workers in these factories will be like, for time's sake, maybe just don't do that. And then they'll get hurt and their like clothing will get caught and whatever. They'll lose a hand or their life. And then they won't report it because they're at the bottom of the food chain and they don't want to get deported. And so they're just, immigrants are always so prone to mistreatment because they don't have any power. And so they have to put up with so much garbage. Yeah.
And I think what we get in the scriptures, this is like, if we're going to go, because we're from Sema Faith, right? I think that what we see in the scriptures, not just about immigrants, I mean, I think we've talked about all the texts, like, you know, how we're supposed to care for the immigrants, and that's all true. But I see like, even like the story of the Exodus, you see folks who have had to move, they're coming to a new land, right? They've escaped and they've had to kind of trick a super powerful group of people, right? With the help of God. And then we also see this constantly in the Hebrew scriptures. We see this idea of like, be cunning enough to not have the power, but to trick the power.
You know what I mean? Which is what we see Laszlo doing. Totally. Yeah.
Right. So that's like a high, to me, that's like one of these values is like, how do we, and Jesus comes into a power structure where he is not powerful, where he is in a subjugated Roman run joint. He's not in the end. He doesn't have the, I mean, obviously he's God, but he chooses to like inhabit the flesh, to dwell in flesh and to be in the midst of folks. And he's in a group of people that don't have the power, but have to have their dignity and identity still.
Right.
And like, how do you navigate that? Because I think as white guys, we don't navigate that much. We don't have to code switch. We don't have to, at least in our culture, you know, in the culture now, we don't have to like tiptoe around things and like think five, chess master, think five steps ahead. But I think most people do.
And it's always the paradox of the gospel, right? It's like the little mustard seed that starts off with no power, so small, and then it grows up to become the center of everything. And Jesus is all powerful as God and yet has no power in the time that he chooses to commit to. That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's hard. I think the closest thing that like I can connect to this is when I had to do fundraising, and you'd have some folks that were like very creepy, but they had a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to do fundraising, and they may not even barely get the vision sometimes, but for the sake of the community and the people, I had to fundraise. And I saw a lot of my friends who were African-American pastors would have to do stuff like figure out how to get resources for their community because people were suffering, but they had to deal with folks that were like super out of touch and wanted to have like total control of how everything went.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep your identity, but also get the stuff for your community? And I think that's like one of the places where we don't see in film, we don't see that represented in film. So I saw that represented here and it was like, it's icky. It's gross business.
It's slimy. And Van Buren is such a perfect microcosm of that very sort of white, like not overt bigotry, but like it's all under the surface and like that you see, I think, in those kind of situations where, you know, these wealthy donors, they're being so generous, but yet it's really all about them and it's gross.
Yeah. But there's a fine history of this occurring in art, right? Even like what's the Sistine Chapel has one of the, I think it's one of the people that commissioned the Sistine Chapel, I think, is like portrayed as Satan or something.
Yeah,
or
oh
Judas,
gosh.
I think. I can't remember the story. But anyway, you have that. I've been to places where, like even like folk art, where I went to this place in California and they depicted like the person that paid for everything wanted to depict like all these scenes from scripture, like in concrete and rebar.
Okay.
So the person did it and then the guy was like going to short him on the bill. And so he took Judas and he put his face of the donor as Judas.
Oh, no. I love it. Yeah. Oh, no, his own subversion of it. Yeah, great.
Right. And then the guy paid for that, right? you see some of that here.
It's like clever taking your power back. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's beautiful.
If you don't have it or if you can't get it, you have to try to get it in creative ways. So I also see like creativity as being of course, and these are all artists that we're dealing with for film, creativity is a way to gain power.
Yes. People just naturally respect it. Yeah.
And I think we tend to think money is a way to get power. Now, that's true. You do get, if you have power, you have the ability to act, right? So money can be power. But I think this creativity can be a form of power too, or a form to access power. That's why you see some of the greatest creativity coming out of folks who have been the most oppressed.
Yeah. And I think we'd be remiss not to say in 2025, like, immigrants are too often the target, and we're seeing it again. We're seeing it play out again. It's just so easy to target them. And I feel like what's happening nowadays is very similar to the Jews and also just the immigrants throughout history, is that it's like we've projected all of our problems onto this group of people who are vulnerable and have no power, when in fact, crime rates are actually much higher for native-born people. They're not out there committing crimes. They really just want to work. And instead, we are treating them like the ultimate villain in our story. And we're deporting them like crazy right now. And in fact, it's just gotten really crazy. Like, I'm not trying to be overly political, but these are just facts. We're building a detention center. We built a detention center in Guantanamo Bay, and we just sent our first shipment off to there. Marco Rubio announced that that we're going to send immigrants of any nationality to a prison in El Salvador to help pay for their prison system. Like, it's insane what's happening. And we are called to look out for the most vulnerable among us. And they are.
Yeah. I think all that stuff's evil. Like, I'll just call it what it is. It's evil. You know, and there's no way to disagree with this. If you're a Christian and you're having an internal conflict, you're not conflicting with John or I. This is just straight. Jesus wouldn't do this stuff.
Yes.
And he wouldn't be a part of it.
That's right.
It's just evil. So if you're struggling with this, good. Like, you should be struggling with it. And then as far as action goes, like, my sense would be, like, I think a lot of us feel powerless right now. We feel like this is being done to us. Like, this is a rape. You know what I mean? I don't mean it like, I mean metaphorically, but like, it's
exactly.
So how do we deal with this power that we cannot overpower? We can't overpower it. How do we deal with that in creative ways? And so, like, right now we're living in this, I'm just going to be straight up, it's a tyrannical regime that wants to take away the rights of the most vulnerable people and wants to concentrate power for white people.
And wealthy people.
And wealthy people. So how do we as Christians go, no? And how do we do it in a creative way? It's not going to be like, right, your congressman probably, okay? That's probably not what it's going to be. It's going to have to be subversive. And so we look at Laszlo as a model of that. How do we creatively deal with this? How do we subversively deal with this? How do we stay alive, but also at the same time, you know, we stay alive, we function, but we also have to work subversively against this stuff, because, you know, if we have the executive and we also have half of the legislative all about this, how do we as Christians stand up and be part of what Jesus is doing here?
And I think that one bishop is a great example, you know, she was able to just not be rude, you know, but just asked for a plea for mercy for them. And I think that we need more of that energy.
And be smart about it too, right?
Right.
We're not going to like come and like give Pharaoh a lecture. Like, and then the thing that isn't going to work is going to be posting a bunch of social media. That's not going to work.
I know. It's hard because you want to raise awareness for what's going on. And it feels like so many people are just asleep to what's happening. But like, I agree that it probably is very low impact.
Yeah. And it's a long battle. That's the other thing. Like, I look at the film as a good model for us, which is there's not going to be an overnight. There's a lot of evil that's running rampant right now in our country. And it's hurting people. People aren't getting their malaria shots. People aren't getting food aid.
People are dying. Exactly.
People are dying. And so we have to fight against that. And I don't tend to be very political, but like, it's very clear. And if it's not bothering you, you need to take a look at yourself. And then if you're not moved to action, start thinking about what you can do to care for the least of these and care for people who are suffering right now.
Yeah, I like what you said about the long game, because it's like, how long did it take Laszlo to build this structure? He finally builds it, this big act of subversion, but it took so many years. And like, the power, like, it's, I think that's the thing, is that we look at power and we think like, we just want it to be dismantled now, but it often, they win for a season and then it comes back around and justice reigns again. And so we just have to hang in there.
So, you know, I look at it and it's not, I think people a lot of times white people who are like, want to like be part of something, I think tend to like, what's the word for it? We like glamorize this, like glamorize a movement or make it cool to like be
resist
woke or whatever.
Right.
Resist and wear the t-shirt and post your social media. That's not what this is. This is more strategic. We need to think creatively about how to fight evil. And sometimes evil wins. But how can we do that? So yeah, I think that this film is very appropriate for where we are right now.
Absolutely. All right, Tim, what are your final thoughts on The Brutalist and your letter grade?
Final thoughts, good movie. Don't bring the kids. I give it an A. It's a solid A. We've had some great movies this year, and I would put it in there. I don't know if it's the best picture, but I think it's a really great movie.
All right. So I think it's a great movie. A lot to admire here. The acting is phenomenal from all three of the principal leads. The characters are so rich and layered and wonderful. I'm giving it an A-. I struggled with that ending. I'm sorry. I just, it's not forgivable for me. I can't say it's perfect because I just really feel like something's lost and that we genuinely don't know what happened to the characters for the next 20 years. Stop it. Give me a break.
Oh, man.
Anyway, it's me. It's just me, maybe, but A-. So that's what I'm going with. But yeah, there are so many scenes in this movie that are some of the best of the year. Like, it's that good.
Mm-hmm. I'd say the acting is even better than the script.
Yeah.
I know it sounds weird, but the acting is so good in this film. If you just like good acting, great. The cinematography is so good. If you just like cinematography, great. The script is good. We already talked all through that, but I definitely think it's worth watching on the big, and once again, in the biggest format that you can.
See it in a theater if you still can, which is still should be playing around the Oscars and stuff, because yeah, this is a theater movie. The cinematography, you can catch it in 70 millimeter. I would love to watch it in 70 millimeter. I didn't, but that would be great. So yeah, great movie to watch in the big screen. All right, Tim, that's a wrap on 2024. That's it, man. We podcasted through another year of movies. It's so great.
Dude, I love it.
It was a great year for movies. Like, it genuinely was. Great films.
It was. There's a lot of films to watch. I still haven't gotten to all that. John, are you doing write-ups?
No. So here's the thing. I just ran out of time. I missed two of the movies that are nominated for everything just went out of theaters, so I can't see them until the weekend before the 2 days before the Oscars. So it's okay. It's low-key. I don't even think we're going to have a live chat this year. It's a low-key time for the award season. But what will happen is I will finalize my top 10 list before the Oscars. So check it out. Nice. On the weekend of the Oscars, I will have what I believe are the top 10 movies. I'm going to see Sing Sing, Dan Baker, because that's his favorite movie of the year, and he has been wanting me to see it for a long time. So,
like,
I will,
the prison,
yeah, about the prison with.
Oh, I haven't heard about that.
It's supposedly fantastic. I really want to see it, so I'm going to watch that, and I'm going to watch all the other ones.
Can't stream it right now.
I think you can stream Sing Sing because that came out streaming in a few months ago. But there are a couple big movies that you can't stream right now, and you got to wait. But yeah. So anyway,
all right,
I'll look for that.
The top 10.
Top 10. All right, Tim, thank you so much for joining me for another year. We're going to take a month off, and we'll be back in April with our first movie of 2025.
Yay!
Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.
Working on a night moves, trying to make some front page driving news. Working on a night moves. Summertime. Some high in the sky summer.